Yeah, thank you very much for having me here and giving me the opportunity to talk about my work. And I try to make it as non-technical as possible. And at some point you will see a few of the details so that you understand the principles of how things are evolved. So the basic idea of what we are doing in my group, I mean, there's always a lot of graduate students involved in what one is doing, especially when it comes down to the real programming. But our basic incentive is to look at evolutionary designs in nature, or designs in nature in general, and then ask, well, how did nature come up with these designs? And of course, evolution is one of the main principles or techniques that nature uses to come up with different designs. As you see here, different eye designs, and eyes have been involved in the course of living systems several times. And there are very different solutions to the problem of getting to see things in your world. So, because I'm a computer scientist, I'm interested in not only the biological aspect of these designs, but more or less in how can we use this method of designing things in general using evolutionary techniques. So the idea is, can we actually program a computer by means of simulated evolution? And any one of you knows who has tried to program a computer, programming a computer is a pretty painstaking task. If you change a semicolon for a comma, the compiler will not accept that. I'd say, well, I don't understand what you mean. One really has to find the right level. And I actually want to take it on an even higher level and ask, well, can we actually program a computer without explicitly telling it what to do? Well, that sounds a little bit crazy, but I can show you examples what I mean by that. And one of the classic examples that one finds in the literature and has been used as a classic in testing what is called genetic programming methods is the so-called ant tracker. And it's a very simple task. I'm going to guide you through that, and then we'll see how it's actually done, and then I'll show you more examples that are advanced versions of that ant tracker. So let's suppose we have the following simple task. We have a discrete world, and in this world we have walls, the blue squares or the blue parts here, and we have a little ant. And if there are any biologists in here, an ant has three body parts, so it actually can't be an ant. But for some reasons in artificial life research, these little robots that evolve or that you try to manipulate are called ants. So I called mine an ant as well. And why is it called an ant? Well, this is a hungry ant, so it actually should learn how to pick up food pieces. And all these green pieces you see here are food pieces. And what the ant should learn is actually to come up with a program to pick up all these food pieces. Now, if you look at this task, it's actually not a completely simple task. At the very beginning, it has to learn that, well, there is one food piece after the other, so just straight ahead. But then the path curves several times. But then there are also gaps in between. And I call these gaps, which are marked as yellow squares, pheromone squares. Because if the ant actually learns how to use these squares, namely in the sense that if it just goes on that, steps on that square, or steps on the next yellow square, next pheromone square, it will actually be taken to the next food piece. Right, so it could learn how to use that as a hint where to get to the next food piece. And so you actually see the path gets more complicated because there are gaps, and there are longer gaps, and there are gaps at corners, and even longer gaps. And so it gets the task becomes more difficult the further the ant advances in its learning task. So it's not a completely stupid problem, but it's also not unsolvable, because if you sit down for 5 minutes, even if you're not a computer scientist, you can figure out how you would actually navigate this ant. And the first step you would do that is to actually think about how should it move in that environment. And first of all, it has to move, right? So you want to build in a command that says advance. So in this, because it's a discrete world, you would say, well, it just advances by one step wherever it's heading towards at this particular point in time. And then you want it to be able to turn, so we have a left turn 90 degrees and a 90 degree right turn. And at some point, you might actually want a command that doesn't do anything, right? So you basically stop and don't do anything. So that makes it move. But moving alone is not enough, because you might bump into walls and you might have to turn away from walls. So you have to figure out what's actually happening in your environment. So for that, you could say, well, there were a set of commands that make the ant see the world, perceive the world. So, because we have basically four different things it could see in this world, namely food, the green things, the pheromones, it could see wall, or it could see the white, anything that I call dust here. So I have basically four commands that say, if I as an ant see a food square in front of me, I can do either A or B. If I see a pheromone square in front of me, I can do A or B, and the same for dust and wall. And A or B could be any of the commands you see here. So now the task for the evolutionary system is, you throw these building blocks of commands at it and say, build me a program from these building blocks, and I'm sure these are sufficient to solve the task, and then give me a program, or evolve a program, so in the end you spit out a program that actually solves this task, right? So of picking up all the food particles. So how could one do that? So from the evolutionary algorithm perspective, one would, and I'm going to come back to that slide a little bit more often.
There are a lot of seeds on this side.
You would basically start up with what I would call a genome. So it's almost like having a DNA that represents how an organism is built. And this genome would then have to be translated into a real computer program that some real computer can understand. So you translate it into C or Mathematica or some language that makes sense to your computer. And once you have that, you actually have a program, so you run it, and once you can run it, it has to be judged in how far it actually reaches the solution for the problem. So you would set up some sort of environment in which that program is tested, and that environment, by testing within which you test the program, would actually give you what one could call a fitness value. Right, so, and these terms are, of course, genome and program and fitness are taken from evolutionary biology. So we have basically a chromosome, and that is tested as a phenotype in the environment, in the natural world, and depending on how well you do, you survive or not. Right? And now comes the second part of the evolutionary strategy. You basically say, well, I have fitness values, and I have my genomes, so how do I get from one generation of genomes to variations of that genome, so offsprings, right? So you would have a selection procedure depending on these fitness values, and you would have what I call your mutation operators. A little bit later on, I will show you how these actually work, because it very much depends on the representation of your programs in particular, right? But this is basically a loop that you start with some genome, you basically test the program for your particular application area, you get a fitness value back, and then depending on your fitness value, you pick the ones, so basically the best ones survive, so to speak. And but then you into the next generation, you feed in mutated versions of those, because you just don't want to keep them unaltered in an unaltered way. So how would that look like for the ant tracker task? Well, the fitness criterion would just be the number of collected food pieces. So just let you write a little simulation that lets whatever program you generate run in this little environment, and you then count how many food pieces has it picked up. You have to basically limit the number of action steps, because if there is an unlimited amount of time to solve the task, any random walk will solve the task eventually, so that's not a challenge, right? So in this case, for each command, each of these eight building blocks, it just counts as one action step. So it can only do 400 action steps at most, and then it has to be able to solve the task. So one has to find out what that number is exactly for the task to be solved. And another important fact for evolutionary algorithms is, you now do this search in parallel. So we have a whole population of these programs, and you let them all run, you just all evaluate them, and then from this population, you do the selection on the offspring, you do the mutations, etc., etc. So in this case, 50 individuals per population are enough, and you let the whole system run over 100 generations. So it's not a very big problem, because it's designed as a toy problem. And the genetic operators are, among others, mutation and crossover, and there are other mutation operators built into our system that we are not going into detail today. So just to show you some results, if you now randomly generate programs from these 8 building blocks, right? So the navigation commands, the move command, the do nothing command, and the if sensor commands, and you look at these 50 randomly generated programs and pick the best one, the best program then just has one command, namely advance. And what it does, of course, is this. It just lets this ant go forward and forward and forward and forward and bumps into the wall. So out of 50 randomly generated programs, this is the best program. And that happens to be because there were 6 food pieces in front of you. So the best thing to get at least 6 fitness points is to just go straight ahead, even if you're bumping in the wall. It's not a good idea to turn away. It's not a good idea to do nothing. It's not a good idea to turn around. So that's the best program you can get if you do it randomly. And another lesson one can learn from that is it's not good enough just to randomly generate programs. That will not solve your task, right? Even if you generate 10,000, you will still not get very far. It will certainly not be solved by a random search. Okay. So in generation 5, you actually get a relative, a much bigger program, and you can just read them. So just ignore the SEQ, which is basically a sequence, but it says go forward one step, then if I see dust, I stop. Otherwise, I go forward one step. If I then see dust, I turn left. And I turn left until I don't see any dust, etc., etc., etc. But you can actually read these programs through if you know what this little in-between language means. And what it does is this here.
So this is actually the best program generated.
So that's the best program of generation 5. So it went through this mutation crossover cycle for 5 times after generation 0. And that's the best program you get after these 5 iterations, right? And as you've seen, it basically moves a little bit more in a more complicated fashion, not very in a very smart way, because still it bumps into the wall, and when you actually look at the program more closely, you can see it has no way to turn away from walls, so it will always bump into walls. Right? But the big learning step here is that it actually just does more than just going straight and not doing anything more complicated, but moving around. Right? It has a lot of these if sensor statements in there, which will turn out to be useful building blocks for further generations. Because if you look at, say, generation 16, so we're about 11 generations later, the program has almost the same size, and what it does is this. So it actually picks up the food pieces, not in the way we actually expected it to do that, but now you see it walks along the wall, and goes through these openings, this opening. And that's, of course, a big learning step. Well, unfortunately, it misses the food trail because it still is stuck in this routine that keeps it going along the wall. And then again, it also gets stuck down here. So it comes back and it just walks around here in the loop. And you can actually also see that this is a time diagram, how it walks, and time goes up here. So you can see it's just stuck in there. If you look at the program, you can see why that is. It just doesn't know what to do when it's at this stage of the program. But you see it has learned the important step of actually turning away from walls, so walking along walls and walking through openings. And that's, of course, very important to get from this section to another section to another section, etc. Okay, so let's have a look at that in generation 22. The program is actually a bit shorter, but it seems to do the task in a little bit more intelligent way. So it uses a mutated version of that going along the wall program, and now it sticks on the trail, right? So it doesn't go here, doesn't get distracted. It only gets distracted at the very end here, where it doesn't really know what to do. And when, again, you look at the program, you see if there is no food piece or pheromone piece around it, it does not know what to do, so just rotating. And of course, yes, and of course it missed also these food pieces here, right? That's why it didn't get all the, whatever, 45 fitness points, so it's still not perfect. Right? But here is one program, generation 59, all 45 food pieces, that is has actually almost double the size than the program that we saw before. It still does not go with the food trail in the way we expected it to do, to go through the food pieces, but while it clears the whole area, it stays on the food trail. And when you look close, it actually steps left and right and looks if there are food pieces to the left and to the right. And it also looks at regions that might have food, because how do you know that it's all laid up as a connected trail, more or less? And then it picks up all these, and here we go, and just left two pheromone pieces here, but we're not worried about pheromones, right? So this program solves that task. And one can then run a little algorithm and basically say, well, compact it a little bit, because that's evolved, and evolution always produces a lot of mass, basically, because it just plugs in different building blocks. The interesting thing about that program is actually that you can put this ant program on a different trail and will still pick up all the food pieces. So it's not a specialized program for this particular trail, but it just has a program to keep it on the trail. So whenever it steps off the trail, it comes back. It steps off the trail to the right or to the left, it comes back. So it's a very general food pickup program. And you can influence that, whether it's very specialized or not, by what you put into the fitness function. So if you say the fitness function should also include the number of action steps or the length of the program, it will actually eventually specialize. Because if you want to have a program as short as possible, it's better to specialize than to have a very general program that might take into consideration all different kinds of situations. So when you look at this evolution over the program, so that's the one I showed you, so starting off from this very small that program that just advanced until it bumped into the wall over here, the interesting thing to notice is that the overall evolutionary learning system, so to speak, reuses useful building blocks. So here I've just marked commands that are used in an unaltered way that were evolved in generation 5, and it appears in generation 16, generation 22, and 59 at two different places. Right? So what you have learned is stored in this gene pool, and it's reused in later generations whenever it turns out to be advantageous.
Could you give an example here of what mutation is?
I come to that in three slides. Okay, so you will then see how that is done. And here's another example, which is just a bigger routine that is repeated in later generations.
If you start the generation 1 program was put in this by
one?
You or randomly generated?
No, they all randomly generated.
Randomly generated.
I didn't put in any.
So the first program, if it's some other randomly generated thing, the solution would be different?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
But we'll also solve the task,
good.
Yeah. So you get many different versions of doing the same thing,
right.
Probably in different ways, just like in nature, you have many different ways of coming up with eye designs, for instance, right? So, of course, now there are two questions. One is, how do you generate these programs at random from the building blocks? And then the second thing, how do you do mutations and crossovers and these things? So, just to give you, I'm not going into details, but just to give you the idea. Tony and I had a long discussion last night, so I just added that slide because He saw that computer scientists have a very peculiar way of representing formulas. And the way is like this. If you have a formula like f of a and g and b and c, so a function that is applied to two arguments, a and g and c, and g is a function of b and c, we in computer science represent them as trees, or we visualize them as what we call trees. And our trees are upside down, so we actually say the root is up here. And so we draw them in a way that we say, okay, here's a function. So this is the root, and it has two arguments. So we draw these two lines. So here's A, and here's another, the slot for the second argument. And then here's G and of B and C, which is another function of two variables. So we have G of B and C. Right? So you can actually, and you just have to trust me, represent any computer program in that form, in that tree form. At some point when you compile your program, and even when you have an interpreted language like Mathematica, it generates what is called a parse tree. And a parse tree is exactly something like this. It represents the structure of your program as a tree structure. Right? So, having said that, you actually can then think of your population of programs as a population of tree structures. right, which are actually represent symbolic expressions. So that's basically the more general term. And so now the question is, how do you generate a whole population, say 50 different versions of programs that come out of 8 building blocks, so to speak? Okay, here's the way, one way of doing it. Let's say it basically works like a Lego system. In a Lego system, you have different blocks, and some blocks fit together and others don't. So what we do is basically specify these blocks that the system can use, and then make it generate things randomly because it has choices which blocks to actually take. So we could, for instance, say, well, this is taken from a later example, but just doesn't matter. It don't really look at what the labels are. It just pay attention to the tree structure. So it would basically pick one of these Lego blocks, so to speak. We call them templates. And the templates consist of two parts. The green parts are the fixed parts. And the red parts are plugins. So at these points, you actually can plug in something else that fulfills a particular matching criterion. So this basically says, we start with this L system top part, which could be a function, like this function mf. And then this would have two arguments, so to speak. So we now, and this red thing here means that we can now plug in something that starts with axiom. So we basically search in our search pattern, find this axiom down here. So we plug it in here. And the other one would be L rules. So we look for something that has L rules. So this one here, so we plug it in here. And then we continue that process. Well, axiom is done because that just has green parts, whereas L rules has a red part here, right? So we look for a red part that actually matches this L rule, so this head basically, and here we find one. So we plug that in here and get a bigger expression, right? So we plugged it in here because here's an L rule here. I just put dots here, right? So now this one again has two red parts, so we have to fill in the red parts and just continue that way. So in that way we pick things, and sometimes you have two choices. Where you say, well, it could be either this one or that one, right? So, and that's the way how these expressions are built. So you basically say, these are the building blocks, and they plug together in a particular way, and there at some point there are choices. If there are no choices, you always generate the same tree, right? So at some point they have to be these choices. Okay, so that's the way how these you generate these populations of different programs. Now the second part that is interesting is, how do you mutate the program trees? So how do you get from the parent individuals, so to speak, your parent programs, to slightly mutated offspring programs, or very much mutated offspring programs? So the system basically can do a whole bunch of operators. So I'm just going to look at two of them. The first one, which is very important, is what is called the crossover operator. And the idea is actually very simple. So you have a population of your programs all represented as trees. So with crossover, you basically pick two individuals, because now you want to cross over between two programs. Then within these programs, you pick two what is called subtrees or sub-expressions. Right? So you say, okay, I pick this green one here, and I pick this red one here. And why is it called crossover? Well, because I crossed them over. Right? So just take this one and that one, just cross them.
So you let the two programs have sex with each other.
Exactly. The two programs have sex with each other. And so the only thing you have to make sure is that this is actually valid, so that when you have this green part down here, it's still a valid program, right? And that if you have this red part up here, that's still a valid program, so that things you interbreed here are compatible with each other. So we have built in some filter system that actually makes that they can define what is compatible, because it doesn't necessarily mean that it just has to have the same head, as is the case here where it says stack head and stack head is. So we basically have the same things plugged in and it will work. Or whether it says, well, can you replace a number for a constant or something like this. So the next operator would be a mutation operator, where you just pick one individual, and here it is, and then within that individual you pick a subtree, so for instance this red one, and then using so you delete that one, and then using these templates you generate another subtree that again should be compatible for what you want just had deleted, and then just put that in there. right? And you get a new program. So that's very simple operators, and it still seems to work. And that's actually the amazing thing. And to show you that that works, not only for the ant example, I've basically a whole collection of things that I could show you, and we just see how time goes by. So I skip a few examples, and if we have more time at the end, I can show you a few more. And I also want to give you a little demo of how that works, so that you don't think everything is fake here. These are a few projects that we have worked on over the last, the flowers are basically from 5 years ago that I did, and all the rest of the projects have been done during the last 1 or 2 years. Maybe I should just go to this fractals example, because it basically adds another little dimension to what we've just seen with the ants example. Every one of you, while you're physicists, you know fractals. One of the simplest ways of generating fractals is through replacement systems. So you can use iterative function systems, but in this case I just use these replacement systems. You will see why, because later on I use a replacement system to actually evolve plants. And that's the connection with the so-called Lindenmeyer systems. So the idea is very easy. In a very visual way, you could start off with a starting expression, which is in Lindenmeyer system, it's called an axiom. So it's just a square that consists of these four lines. And then you have a replacement rule. You say, replace each line by this zigzag sort of thing. And now you can encode that by what is called a so-called turtle interpretation. It's called turtle interpretation because there's a programming language called Logo. Maybe some of you know that language. And the idea was that you have a turtle on the screen and you can navigate it on the screen. So you could say, well, go forward. It's almost like the ant tracker. Go forward, then turn left 45 degrees, go forward, turn left, go forward, etc. So you could draw things on the screen by writing these little Logo programs. Now you can do the same thing here. You can say, well, I have my turtle, my drawing device, and it say it's heading in a direction to the right. So in order to draw this square, it would have to go forward, so it would draw this line, it would have to turn left 90 degrees, would turn up to the top here, then go forward, would draw this line, turn left, draw this line, turn left, draw this line, and you're done. Right? So this actually describes the drawing of that square. And now if you want to translate this replacement rule, you could say, well, each F represents a line, so you replace F by this more complicated string, which just represents this structure, because you go forward, then you turn left, you go forward, you turn right, you go forward, you turn left, etc., right? So you can represent this geometrical structure as a string, basically. If you apply this rule here, starting with a square, and do it once and twice and three times, four times, you actually get something. It's called the quadratic Koch island, which is one of the famous fractals. Because it's obviously self-similar because the rule you generated is self-similar. So if you then look at this from the viewpoint of how are they represented as these strings, it looks a little bit more complicated, but that's just the commands for this turtle to actually draw that particular structure here. Right? Just a little bit longer, and when the computer takes care of that. So now here comes the idea where evolution comes into play. If we have a rule system like this here that replaces each line by something else, why can't we evolve those rules and see what happens? So we change these rules and see what happens. So it's a very simple system. We just have basically a three-letter alphabet. We have F, we have L, and we have R. Now we could mutate an R for an L, an F for an L, an L for an F, etc., right? And the question is, what would one expect to see? Well, something like these. So we started off with a square, and we generated different fractals. And to some extent, they were evolved for particular criteria, but you get a whole universe of different-looking fractals. And they're very simple systems. They are all just one generation rule. So some actually have a threefold symmetry. Some look like very geometric structures. Others look like more biological structures. Others don't have too much symmetry. And so you get a whole range of different things that are interesting to see to just come out of these very simple rules that you mutate. And so here you don't have any symmetric structures anymore. And then you can ask, well, is there any pedigree tree of these things? Well, we can reconstruct that pedigree tree because we know how we generated them. But for instance, in biology, and especially now with the Human Genome Project and these things, what you have usually is the phenotype. So you usually see a picture of something. Now the question is, what does the generating system look like for this particular picture? Right. So that's then the big challenge, and no one really knows how to do that. So can we involve, actually infer the DNA setup from an organism, which is very complicated. But we could start with simple systems like these and try to find how can you do that. And that actually takes us to another example I want to show you, which I call the art flowers. And here the idea is to bring in another aspect into these programs, namely the aspect of development. So how can you, first of all, model something that grows, like a plant structure? So here you see actually 9 frames of a plant structure that grows. And can you evolve these things, these programs? Because they are just programs, right? So you can just apply the same paradigm and say, well, can we evolve a plant that has a particular characteristic? Mm-hmm. Okay, so this program for that particular plant that you just saw growing looks a little bit more complicated, but it's still just a rule system. So it's almost like this, just a more complicated version of that fractal system. So here it actually consists of 7 rules. So there are rules that say, well, how does a sprout develop into sub-branches, and how do sub-branches create more sub-branches, and how do leaves grow, how do stalks elongate, where do blooms appear, and where do they decay, and things like that. So you just have little rules to take care of all these things. And of course, there are rules that are more essential to the overall system to generate a growing structure or not, because it might not matter so much whether the leaf changes versus whether you actually get a branching structure that generates another branching structure, etc. But now what we've done is try to build a system that helps you to evolve plants encoded as these so-called Lindemeyer systems. So Lindemeyer was a biologist in the Netherlands, and he passed away in 1989. And his idea was to actually use these Lindemeyer systems to simulate cell growth in cell layers. So he looked at them in 1 dimensions, and then they were extended to 2 and more dimensions. And so they are basically parallel replacement systems, because you have everything in a plant that grows going on in parallel, and you only have local interactions between different branches and substructures within the plant. So that's the basic idea behind these Lindemeyer systems. But now, basically, you can translate these rules into a tree structure. If you have them as a tree structure, you can feed them into this genetic programming system and evolve something. And here are some examples of what you can evolve. So you can start up with a plant like this. Here is just, well, for this one, I think it's just random. And for other examples, I went for specific criteria. So here is just random. Then you can say, well, this is again random with interesting shapes of growing. And you can say, well, how about more plants? Or more blooms, right? So you get a whole bunch of more blooms. And you can either have that fitness criterion evaluated in an automatic way, because we know the graphic representation, the symbolic representation behind it, so we can count how many blooms it has, or we just look at the thing and say, well, this is nice and this has enough blooms. Or we can go for climbing plants, something like this, so that they are very flat and they try to climb up a wall. Or we can go for something like more bushy, right? And we say, okay, well, this looks pretty bushy. But here is another problem with these evolutionary algorithms, or actually a problem in general when you try to infer a mathematical model for something. So if you say, well, can you give me an L system, a mathematical model, that gives me a bushy plant? The question is, well, if I use an evolutionary system, how do I specify bushy? Right? So is there, can I write a formula that gives me a fitness value that says, well, this is more bushy than this one? And that's pretty hard. I mean, once we have that L system, we know what the characteristic is, but you can't really nail down and say, well, this rule was actually the one that was responsible for this bushiness. Right? So it's a very complicated process. So that actually brought us to the idea that an interactive evolutionary system would make a lot of sense, because then, say, a biologist would see the plants and say, if you see these as a population, would say, well, this gets a high rate of bushy, and this one, and the others maybe are less fit, right? And then you can use the system and say, okay, well, these have higher fitnesses, so we now evolve towards these fitnesses and have them mutated, and that gets us more towards bushy plants.
Why can't you change the environment to encourage bushiness?
Because that's even more complicated if you change the environment.
So now you want human intervention, say these two are bushy.
Yeah. And for most cases, biologists don't know too much about the environment.
Environments that will encourage bushiness.
Yeah. Well, you have to have set up a co-evolutionary environment where bushiness pays off to non-bushiness.
Right. Generate a lot of environments and see in some environment that bushiness.
Well, that would be ideal in principle, but who has the computing power to do that?
No, I see not enough computing power.
Yes, that's basically the bottleneck to to simulate a whole co-evolutionary and ecosystem, more or less. Mm-hmm. Right? Okay. We also looked at, okay, maybe I'll show you just the polyhedron example, because everyone knows these polyhedra. So here the idea was, can we look at another example? It's actually simpler than the plants, but we were looking at, can we model, or basically look at an evolution of geometrical objects that are well understood, but look at them as being evolved as phenotypes, so to speak. So we don't have any encoding, we basically work on what we see. So we have these polyhedra, and we have polygons in here, and these consist of lines, so why can't we define mutations on these things, on these objects? So for instance, if we start with the dodecahedron, we can for instance say, well, we take each surface here and just erect, basically stellate it. Right, so erect a pyramid on top of it. Okay, then we can cut off their tops, or we can shrink all of these polygons by some degree, or we can punch in holes, or we can punch in more holes. Right, and these are all done on this particular representation as 3D objects, because it consists of these polygons, and everything is done on these lines and polygons.
What's the difference between the last two steps?
Here we subdivide these here and punch in holes. So this little structure consists of a polygon here, one here, so basically of six polygons, right? And each of them basically gets punched in a hole again, and then you get this net structure, more or less. So what you then can do is you define all sorts of mutation operators on these structures, and again, it's almost like in the fractals, you get quite a nice universe of what you can do with that. I think they were all started off from dodecahedrons, and then some operations actually gave us results that we did not expect. So we have this pyramid erected, and inside of it is a dodecahedron, which was a combination of two different mutation operators that just gave us this effect. Right? Or you get things like these, or like this, right? And that's just for illustration purposes, to actually see, well, what can you do with it? Now, an interesting question is what we haven't solved yet, because that's part of the next step of the system. So how can you then say, well, I like the color of this one, but I would like to have that on this one? And the question is, if you then recombine them just using an evolutionary system, it will be random. So you will not basically be able to steer the system towards, okay, let's have this particular color scheme on this particular polyhedron, right? So you would have to have some means to go into your data structure, basically manipulate your chromosomes and say, okay, this one should go in here, and if I plug this in here, this characteristic in here, then it will turn out to be a blue star-like polyhedron. And this then takes us to another project we are actually doing together with the Faculty of Fine Arts. And here the idea is, how can we come up with new ideas of generating sculptures? And so you can actually then come up with things like these, where here the idea is, because we start off very simple, that you have what we call these blobs in three-dimensional space. So when you look at all these structures, they look, they have this organic look, and probably best explained by this one, they all consist of a collection of spheres in three-dimensional space. We call them blobs. And so you have, say, a blue blob here, and another blob here, another blob here, one blob here, one blob here, one blob here, another one in the front here. And the encoding for these is, where in 3D space is a blob, what's its color, and how is it scaled in X, Y, and Z. So in order to get a very flat blob like this one here, it just has a very flat scaling in the X dimension, right? So this is basically our chromosome. We say, where is the blob, which color does it have, what is the scaling X, Y, Z, right? And then we just generate a bunch of those and put them together, and there is what is called an implicit surface software that then basically makes them merge together if they get close to each other. So it's almost like throwing a net on top of them and then drawing them. So you get all sorts of different things. And maybe I have enough time to actually show you this demo, how you actually come up with these things. So the basic idea of our program is that we have what we call an evolutionary kernel system. And this evolutionary kernel system rests on Mathematica, so this computer algebra and programming language. And then Mathematica connects to other programs that either do the fitness evaluation or do some visualization, as in this example. And the templates I showed you and the mutation operators are all done in this we call it Evolvica system. And so here's an example of doing this interactive evolution. So you would get, let me just get my little window here, because I need that for the next generation. So what it pops up is now a randomly generated population of designs. I just need that on the side here, and then bring my other window back. Okay, right, so you have these to select from. So you could say, well, maybe this is a nice design. They're all interactive 3D structures, so you can actually all blow them up and then interact with them in 3D and look at them all different angles, and say, okay, which ones do we like? So again, we have this problem of looking at plants and say, well, what is a bushy plant? Right? So that's again the idea here, and we put a ranking scale in here. So from zero, so you can rank each of these designs from 0 to 10. Say, okay, if you want to evolve them towards, say, something like this here. And maybe this one, so we could give this a 10. Let's give this a 10. And maybe we give this a 10 as well. And all the others have a fitness, a default fitness of 5. And then we say, okay, that now give us a next generation of that. So it takes these ranks as fitness values, feeds it into the evolutionary system, and comes up with design. So now you see actually the one that we had up here has now 4 representatives, right? And the one we selected down here has this, which is a slightly mutated version of it. And this one just, well, came in because, well, its evolution is a stochastic system, so it picked another one. And when you actually look at them, they are all different, right? Even, so I can stop these. Oops, let's see. Oh, I just have to move them. Okay, here we go. Move them. Right, so also they look pretty similar. They are all different. So this has the ring at this different point, and this is a little bit bigger than this one here. This has this different. This has a little thing down here. So they are all slightly different versions of one thing. And then we can just continue in that way and say, well, this again gets a 10, and say this gets a 10, and maybe we just reduce this to 1, so we won't see that again, or hopefully not. That's a very small population, so it should not show up again. And just do that over several generations. And you don't have to do that 100 times, you usually have to do it 20 times or something like this if you want to evolve towards something specific. And again, you see you get a lot of different mutations of that whole thing. And you can, well, it depends very much on how you set up your initial structures, because if you want the more sculptural looking things, you would just change the distribution of your structures more or less. So if I do this here, and then I think I just have to restart this here. Right, then you get these other sculptures, and then you can say, well, where do you want to go? Do you want to go for something that looks like a bicycle or a spaceship or something like this? And now of course, the big challenge is, how can we combine it with an interactive approach where you would say, well, now I want to add a blob here, or I want to draw something in there. And right now we have to do that on the chromosome, basically on the program that draws these things. And we just have to come up with better user interfaces. But in principle, you can do all these things. So that's one example. Okay, and that actually brings me to basically the second part of my talk and the second part of the interest in my group, which is in swarm systems. And these swarm intelligence systems came out of the idea of social insects. So for instance, when you have an ant colony has an interesting way of how it's designed. If you look at an ant is a relatively simple little organism, and it probably has a couple of rules how you can model it and how it interacts with the environment. So it's certainly not 1,000 rules, it's probably a dozen rules or something like this from a computer science perspective. And then you would say, okay, an ant by itself is not a very complicated organism, but if you put 10,000 ants together, you suddenly get interactions among these ants. So you suddenly build an ant colony, and you get emergent behavior that you haven't programmed into the system, because that colony has task sharing and switch their tasks, they build hierarchies, a whole ant colony acts like a big superorganism. Many people have drawn the parallels between, well, how our bodies are built from so and so many millions and billions of cells versus an ant colony, where you also have these little ants interacting, and from these you get this superorganism that almost works like one body, so to speak, right? Because it feeds itself, it grows, it defends itself against other colonies, etc. So that's where this whole swarm intelligence area starts off. And two of my students have taken that to an actually nice application area, where the idea is, how can we model different aspects of these swarm systems? So here's one that just, well, we have a simulator that can generate these swarms. And well, actually, the simulation engine has been implemented by John Klein, who worked in Sweden and did his master's thesis there. And so we use simulators like these to then plug them into an evolutionary system, of course, because we are interested in evolution. Or we look at things like on a very different level, so not on a bird level or something like this, but on a protein interaction. So we're just starting a project where we think about how can we actually control or model interactions of proteins based on the swarm applications, swarm method. But here is something that Okay, well, I have another demo, which I'll probably show at the end when we have enough time, because I don't want to tire you out. But here is one thing that two of my students built, Joan Penna and Ricardo Hoare, and they were interested in, well, how can we build a traffic system based on ant behavior? So they built this traffic system where you see roads, and it's interactive system, so you can build these roads, multi-lane roads, connect these roads to an intersection, and then put in traffic lights and say which lanes these lights control. And then you can put in seed regions where you seed in cars into the system, so cars can come from here and from here and from there, and here are the cars. And the cars drop pheromones, and other cars sniff these pheromones. So that's the only way they interact with each other. And the interesting thing is, although it's a very simple communication mechanism, it actually leads to very realistic behavior of these cars. So if you look at these, they kind of tailgate and they get hold distance between each other. When they line up at a traffic light, right, they stop because they sniff the pheromone of the cars in front of them, and things like that. So you get all this behavior sort of emerging from the system by just saying, well, this is the only way of them to communicate through these local pheromones, and they just pick up these pheromones, and that's how they influence their behavior. And here's another example where you can then see that it looks quite realistic how they basically drive to an intersection and keep track of each other and keep track of where the other cars are. And it's a completely decentralized system, so you don't have to have any central communication that says, well, this car is here and this car is there, so they should be careful not to crush into each other. Mm-hmm. But the pheromones basically take care of that.
And the pheromones decay very rapidly.
And they decay, exactly. That's actually a very, very important aspect, that they decay after a while, just like the real pheromones for the ants. And that means, well, basically it's a self-adjusting, self-organizing system, because you have this certain information only for a certain period of time in this particular local environment.
So the collision is built into the program. When a car sees a lot of pheromones, it will slow down.
Yes, exactly. So the more pheromone it sees, the more it slows down. So that's the only rule.
Is that program evolved or also?
No, this program has to be built, because it's a very complicated program. Now we know how these rules for the cars work, and we actually have evolved something in that system. And the something was, from a more practical point of view, namely, if you build road systems, the question is, and you put in traffic lights, the question is, how do you time your traffic lights so that the overall waiting time of the cars is minimized? So we've set up a few benchmark examples, and here is one where we have one main road, so to speak, which is a four-lane road, so the traffic goes in this direction and that direction, and 90% of the traffic in this system goes from left to right or from right to left, right? And the rest of 10% of the traffic goes on this side road, which crosses the main road at three intersections.
So now you can change lanes also?
No, in this example they... Yes, they actually change lanes.
So what are the rules for changing lanes?
I think it's random. If there is space and you want to take over another car, you change lanes. Mm-hmm. Right? So it's very, very simple rules. But now, as you see in this movie, the traffic flow is not continuous, right? Because the traffic is stopped for maybe this one or two cars that want to cross, and then again it's stopped here, right? So it's not optimized in any way. Right?
But all the lights light at the same time.
No, the lights are actually at random. Okay.
They seem to be.
Yeah, for this one, okay. For this one, they do it at the same time. So that basically was our starting generation, and now the evolutionary algorithm comes in setting up these light timings so that the overall waiting time for the 90% traffic on the main road gets reduced.
So that's generation one.
That's generation one. That's our random initial generation with synchronized traffic lights. So and okay. Oops. Let me see where my cursor is. So if we then look at that after 30 to 50 generations, so we ran a few experiments here, then you see that the traffic flow is actually much more continuous. Of course, at some point it has to stop, but for instance, this traffic light was just getting green before the main traffic approached that intersection. And so it's a relatively big system that has been built. So here you, for instance, see the fitness value, which is the overall waiting time of the cars within the system, and it can interact with the system while it's running, so it can change the mutation rates and the crossover rates and things like that. So it works relatively fast. So within half an hour, you can actually evolve something that actually reduces the overall waiting time. And people at Civil Engineering and the City of Calgary were actually quite interested in that approach. Okay, and just to wrap up, to give you some eye candy, here's another project with the Faculty of Fine Arts, where we now approach the generation of art, of pictures, of images from the swarm perspective. So not, well, we also have an evolutionary component built in, but not in these examples yet. And the idea is, when you paint, it's basically a very centralized approach from a swarm perspective, because you have a painter, and a painter paints on the canvas. So how about if the paint paints? So the brush strokes paint by themselves. So here we have an example of, here we have a little swarm system, and the swarms, each of these little traces here represent one brush stroke, basically a little swarmette, we call them, and they swarm around that environment and generate these lines. And now we can direct them. So we have an object point, a goal point, and now if you leave the goal point, say in the center of the screen, all the little swarmettes, the whole swarm will actually diverge towards that particular point. And then you can move that point, so now it's moved up here, so then the swarm actually follows your movement, moves, so the whole swarm basically follows your movement on the screen. And you can put in obstacles, so the whole swarm then flows around that obstacle. If you take it away, it will fill up that space eventually, right? And so in that way, you can actually draw things on the screen, but also just leave the system, and it will do something interesting. And okay, so we get things like these. Change the colors a little bit. Here it's kind of, you have this goal point in the center and just see what happens. Here it actually went around that center point. You can change the background a little bit. And of course, there are a lot of parameters involved in that system. So again, you can evolve these things. So, but it's just a matter of computing power. I mean, we have a system built that actually gives you the means to now select designs you like, pictures you like, and then cross them, crossbreed them, and mutate them. But it's just not ready to run on a PowerBook, so it basically takes a lot of time to actually simulate these swarms. And we actually now have a better system that runs a little bit faster and gives us the a good way to combine this evolve and swarm approach. So this is just a brief overview of what you can do with this evolutionary approach, and then how interaction comes in, just because there is the problem of how to put criteria into a fitness function, into a formula, so you, to some extent, you need the interaction of the user, but that brings in the complication of how do you design good user interfaces, which is completely different from looking at an evolutionary algorithm. So suddenly you have to look at, well, how do you present the system to a user, and it makes sense to use, and it's easy to use, and it has a fast response rate, and all these things. And the second aspect is swarm intelligence systems, and how can we actually program these systems. And it turns out that programming these systems is a big shift in what programmers are used to look at. When we write programs, we usually think of it as, well, we are the controller of the whole program, and there is a centralized unit that calls the functions, and that's how the program works. And it's the same as we look at our how computers work. Nowadays, they have a very fast processor, but everything has to go through this bottleneck of that processor. And at some point, that's not enough. So what we are currently struggling with in computer science and in engineering is, how do we actually build massively parallel systems? Can we build something like, as an analogy being the internet, as an evolvable, adaptive computer? And right now we can't, because, well, there's no way to adapt the hardware in real time. Or there, even if we knew how to connect many particles, if we knew how the brain is connected, we still don't know how it works, because we have no idea how to exchange the signals and make sense of these signals. Right? So dealing with swarm systems, where you put yourself in the perspective of this little agent, and then say, okay, if I encounter this and that event or whatever inputs from the environment, what would I do? And then if you throw 10,000 of them together in this environment, what will happen? It's usually hard to predict. So you have to have a lot of experience in looking at these systems and how they are built. It depends very much on whether, which model you use, whether it's a cellular automaton, whether it's a discrete world, or whether it's a continuous world, whether it's 2D or 3D, and all these things. So there's a lot of things involved in how to get these things programmed and working. And maybe as a last example, I can show you what our idea of programming these systems is. And one way of doing that is, well, we are the evolutionary group, so evolution and genetic programming. So here is another example. I hope it works, because sometimes it just doesn't give you the results, because it's a stochastic system and you just have to retry. So let's see where this works. So here again, you have a little population. I just took four because it PowerBook is not powerful enough to actually run six or eight of these things. Well, we'll see. And so now you see different simulations of a swarm system that basically simulates a flock of birds or something like this. And this actually doesn't seem to really generate anything interesting. So let me just quit that and just restart it, because sometimes the initial random generation just doesn't give you anything interesting. So now the idea is, you look at these simulations, and each simulation is controlled by maybe 20, 25 parameters. And when you look at them, they have very different behaviors. So for instance, this one concentrates very quickly on one swarm, whereas the others go down very quickly, right? So we could now say, okay, well, this is an interesting behavior. Why not select for that one and see what we get? So let's just...
The four population, same program but different parameters.
Yes. Yeah. And this is a big simulation program, and you plug in these 25 parameters. So you imagine, even if you just manually try to manipulate these parameters, there's a huge search space to actually find out what the program is doing. Right?
So biologically, that's interesting. Can have the same genetics setup.
Exactly. Yes.
A few different parameters.
Yes. So the environment is different, right? Different inputs, and see what you get. So let's see if we just crank this up to 10 and leave the other ones, let's just leave the other ones at 5 and see what happens. So now we have actually two simulations that have this effect of concentrating. Well, this actually concentrates now in two swarms, and then basically maybe it forms a line or something like this. And the other ones are doing something different. And you can do this the same thing again. So now you can say, okay, well, let's concentrate on this behavior and give it a 10. And let's give this a 10 as well. And then we should get more mutations, more variations of that particular behavior. Right? And now, of course, the big challenge is how much control do we have over these systems? So if you think of, you're a movie maker and you want to have a special effect, would you be able to actually generate a special effect with that interface and that way of programming it? Right? And, well, again, there are a few challenges, but that's the basic idea, how to cope with that, with those swarm systems, because to a large extent, you have to see them, what they are doing, and then evaluate whether this is the behavior you actually want. And sometimes you want to use those for explorations and just try to find out which parameter settings would give you which behavior, right? And because it's this vast search space, it makes sense to actually use an evolutionary approach, because an evolutionary approach gives you almost the best of both worlds. It gives you the creativity aspect of evolution because it's a stochastic system, but it also gives you an ordered search, because the selection function always seeds out anything that does not close to what you want, right? That does not obey your particular fitness function. So these are some of my students, and if you actually go to my webpage, you can check out some of our projects. We're just building this webpage, so not all the projects are documented. And here's a copy then in your library, and you can go to this website and actually download notebooks, and you can try out some of these examples. Some is very recent work, so I haven't put it up on the web there, but the book has almost 600 pages, so there's a lot to read and to cover, and there are a lot of, I think the notebooks in total are 200 megabyte of data and movies and animations, so it's almost set up as a tutorial to learn how to use these things. And the ant tracker I showed at the very beginning is one of the examples in there. So thank you very much for your patience and attention. Yes.
One is that your building blocks are very low-level operations. And in reality, when people are actually doing the coding, we have a much higher hierarchy. We can put all these blocks together and form a new block,
right,
like subroutines and so on.
Mm-hmm.
How difficult is it to implement such an idea in this kind of evolution?
It's not very difficult because it's the same principle. I mean, higher level building blocks means for you functions or modules or whole programs, right? So that's the question. So
you
could,
yeah, because you do have a length restriction as a fitness criteria, right? You don't want this code to go infinitely long.
Yes.
So that bias, that would be a different bias when you allow subroutine or not, right?
No, it's just a matter of scaling up the system. If your programs are very, very big, if your computer can handle that, the principle is just the same. If your program limit is 10,000 commands versus 100,000 commands, it doesn't change the principle. And you just implement your, or you define your genetic operators not on this low level, but you say it's on this higher level, so you always take whole subroutines, so you basically treat them as black boxes and say, I move these boxes around, right? And then, of course, in order to...
I mean, in your blocks, I mean, you have to remove something at the edge, but if you remove in the middle, then you have to basically satisfy all these criteria for all the ramifications of this part of the code, right?
In the code?
In the tree, suppose
you have
okay. You remove something in the middle.
Right.
And then you have all these dangling bonds.
Dangling bonds, yeah. Yeah, so then that's a matter of how to represent your building blocks, right? I mean, usually you would not, when you think of a big C or Java program, you would certainly not try to evolve the Java code by looking at the letters or looking at variable names or something like this. You would really abstract from that and say, here's something that does this particular job, and this is basically one block. And then it would actually make sense to represent that in a different language that talks about these blocks.
Yeah.
Because, right, then you have a very compact representation.
Yeah.
And that's why I say size does not matter, because you can have as complicated as you like encoded in this one little instruction that could actually call a whole application.
Uh-huh. Okay, and the second question is, can you use this kind of idea to solve the equation, like PDE or integral equation?
Well, we actually talked about that last night.
Yeah, let's
in principle you can.
General questions rather than computer science questions before all the physicists disappear.
Yeah.
What kind of ideas do you get from this talk? What is there any goal? What are relations to or understanding correlation?
The forefathers of this genetic programming approach is genetic algorithms. And genetic algorithms are very powerful general search technique. So it's an optimization method. Right? So whenever you use optimization, like using simulated annealing, using hill climbing strategies, things like that, genetic algorithms fall in that category. So they just give you another means of exploring a search space. Okay? So, genetic algorithms are relatively old. They're about 30 to 20 years old. They were actually invented in the 1970s. And only now computers are powerful enough, or 10 years ago they were just powerful enough and got enough publicity to actually make them turn into very general optimization tools. So whenever you have to solve an optimization problem, you can use these genetic algorithms. And genetic programming is just a step further, because now you look at hierarchical structures. Right? So if you flatten your trees, you can encode a vector of numbers and solve an optimization problem. Now you're asking about applications?
He's asking what kind of insights you would have for biologists.
For biologists, okay.
Not computer science.
Okay. Well, you can give them ideas how important certain genetic operators are. So, how important is crossover? How important is sex? That you interbreed building blocks, right? Things like that. If you leave that operator out, what happens? So it's almost like. You can do that. Yes. It's just a different domain, because then you try to solve a biological problem by trying to simulate evolution in real, right? Whereas if you do something like this, you're actually designing things, and you're optimizing things towards a particular criterion, but you're not worried about is that biologically valid. So it's two different questions. So, but yes, you can do that, because the setup is the same.
When you try to apply this to evolution, you can tell, for example, how fast the evolution read or things like that, given a number of assumptions, or you don't do it?
You can do that. I mean, there are a lot of there's a lot of research going on in, for instance, the convergence of genetic of an evolutionary system, given specific settings, initial settings, and then you can compare that to biological settings, right? And see, well, does that speed up the evolution if I increase the mutation rate, for instance, or not? And again, it's a different question to ask whether you know, from the biological point of view, do you know a biological system where you actually know all the data of mutation rates, crossover rates, things like that. What was the environment in which these things evolved? And then can you build a model system to match that one?
Yes, I guess my question is not whether you could collect this data from biology, but do you find any general trend when you're studying all these different systems?
That's very hard to tell. It's like, is there a general trend in biology? Yes. Things seem to get more complicated when they evolve. And that's what you find by these systems, but it also depends very much on the parameters. So there are things, as I said, the mutation rate has a high influence on the system, because if the mutation rate is very high, you scatter your search quite a bit. Right? So it's I can't give you an answer for that, because it very much depends on your initial settings. It depends on your representation, because it's very different from between genetic programming. And if you have another representation, like in genetic algorithms, where you have a binary string representation. So there are a lot of factors that come in. But once you have a fixed system, you can certainly pick out trends and say, well, if I have a fitness rate very high, what will the system do? What are rules of thumb for setting up the crossover rate versus the mutation rate? And there are there are these rules of thumb, and they actually correspond to what you see in biological systems, that for instance mutation is not as high as the crossbreeding rate, the crossover rate. Right? On the other hand, there are systems like bacterial systems that actually increase the mutation rate once the environment gets stressful. Right? So, and people look at that when they actually adapt the mutation rate whenever you, when your population, for instance, converges too prematurely. Right? So yes, there are a lot of cross links, and you can learn from these systems just like you can learn from cellular automata models for, say, physics. Right? They're very abstract models.
We have a question. Can you think about applying this algorithm to generate like intelligent neural networks? For example, in the case of the ant, instead of having like a genetic code giving each instruction he has to do when he encounters a wall of something, maybe instead of that having a neural network making the decision, then you adjust like a number of neurons, the wave functions, you know, the connections.
Okay, there's a short answer to this. I did that, and it's much more complicated than evolving a program. And it has a very big disadvantage. Every neural network has a very big disadvantage. It's a black box. In the end, you get a matrix of numbers, which are the weights between neurons. And nothing tells you whether this particular neuron is responsible for this action of the network. Whereas with genetic programming, you get a program. So you can read the program, and you can see what it's doing. You can actually analyze what it's doing. Whereas with a neural network, as nice as it seems, it's in the end you get a black box.
But can it be more efficient, neural network, than...
Well, in which sense?
But it more faster? I mean, making, for example, you have a couple of inputs and outputs, instead of looking if this is this and then I do this if, then you just went with a wave function, you just compute the outputs more faster.
Yes, but it's again a matter of what you want. So let me put it that way. If you know the program that does the job that you want it to do, let's say you have an AND program, then you can always make it faster by just putting certain commands in the table, putting things in hardware, simplifying your programs. So that's always possible. And a neural network can only be faster because you can have a table of all the weights, and it just calculates, because it just calculates a summation, right? That's why it's so fast with very simple neural networks. If you have more complicated, like radial basis function networks,
yeah, right.
Then it's more complicated.
It's getting late. So one last question.
Does the swarm of complex objects always have a greater complexity than the individual objects, or is there some relationship by which the swarm can have actually a simpler behavior than the individual
object? That's a very good question. It's actually, one sees both. And the interesting thing about the swarm systems is that you can have very simple rules, and when you throw these agents together, you actually get something more complicated. And that's what you want, because you don't want to have something set up complicated in a complicated way on this agent level, and then of course it's obvious that it gets something more complicated on the higher level, right? So it always has to be a balance. But that's the interesting aspect of these swarm systems, that you say I go on this lower level, which I usually know more about. So you can, for it's easier to track one bird or analyze one bird and see what it's doing than analyzing a whole swarm.
This is quite an opposite way in which like the particles and the gas, like the whole collection of gases, something that we can form more laws about than like, and we have almost no information about the individual guys doing. So
right.
You can even say that the collection of group people is more predictable than a particular person. And like I've seen analogies in other systems in which
right. Okay. Okay. But you look at it from a different perspective. You basically look at the system from a global perspective and say, okay, I build a stochastic model, and I average over the behaviors of the whole population, right? Yes. Yes. And of course, I mean, I'm not saying that swarm systems will make all these other things obsolete. It's just another way of looking at these systems. It's basically the bottom-up approach, where you say, well, you build things from the bottom up and see where you come from. And then, of course, at some point, you want to look at these systems from the top view and say, well, that's what we know about these systems. Are they actually meeting at some point? Right? And even if you build them bottom up, at some point, you want to analyze them and see what they are doing. So you actually then have to take this global view. So I think it's more a complementary view than opposing.
Okay. Let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you very much.